Hey, what's up, everyone? I'm Dr. Miriam Korick, and I've teamed up with Optometry Times to bring to you a new podcast called the You and I Podcast. We're going to be going over updates, research studies, latest up-and-coming technology in our field, and I'll also be interviewing expert guests in future episodes. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of You and I. So as you can all guess from the title, today we're going to be going over the tips and tricks to streamlining your pediatric eye exams. One of the offices that I work in has built its reputation on its vision therapy and myopia management programs. And because of this, the majority of the patients I see in the office are pediatric. I think there's a huge benefit to learning some clinical pearls to be able to boost our confidence as eye doctors when it comes to seeing kids, especially when they're coming in for their first eye exam. So here to join me in going over boosting confidence when seeing pediatric patients and the psychology of how to illustrate the importance of getting kids in to see an optometrist, regardless of results of school screening, is Dr. Damira Sarmandi. Dr. Damira Sarmandi is also a New York City optometrist. She graduated from the SUNY College of Optometry in 2015 and is a fellow of the American Academy of Optometry. She has her own private practice, Sir Eye Care, which is located in Queens, New York. In addition, Dr. Sarmandi works at NYC Health and Hospitals Metropolitan. She has a focus on pediatrics and general ocular disease. She volunteers as an advisor to the nonprofit organization Sights on Health, which provides annual cataract, surgical, and medical missions to those in need in the USA and abroad. So first off, welcome to the podcast, Dr. Sarmandi. I'm so excited to talk to you today and bounce some ideas back and forth about our experiences seeing pediatric patients.
Thank you so much for having me and for that really nice introduction. I'm excited too. Let's get to it.
Yeah, so before diving deep into the topic, I'd love for the listeners to learn a little bit more about you and how you started your practice.
Well, I was born and raised in New York in Queens, and how I started my practice, I never thought that I would. Like, if you would have asked me when I graduated, I don't think I would have said that I want to start something cold, brand new. I don't think I would have said that even in 2018, right? But in 2019, around my neighborhood, Jackson Heights, I saw a new building being built, like a new medical office space. And knowing the neighborhood, I was like, okay, some people say that the area is saturated, but this location is the bomb. I'm like, it's really good, this corner. Because so it's on the corner of 74th Street and Broadway, right across the street of Roosevelt Avenue subway station, the best subway station. And right across the street, there's before it was just like a driving school sort of place. It was really small, like one floor. But then it was a big office building was getting built for medical office spaces. And I went in to look. I couldn't afford the first floor. That was like premium, or actually, well, it was a lot, but I think at the time KFC already like leased it out, like the whole space. And so the second floor was up for grabs. And I'm like, well, medical offices are in the second floor all the time. Like this can work out. And it was still kind of pricey because the location was primo, but I'm like, hey, you know what? Like, I don't know, just a thought, like this would be the perfect spot for this to happen, to do something. And then, like everybody else's story, COVID happened. And the building is still getting built. KFC pulls out. And then the building owners start dividing up the large first floor into like smaller spaces. And so now all of a sudden the ground floor was at a really, really good rental price. And I'm like, ground floor, I know I want this corner. Yes, the city's kind of dead right now, but I know it's going to come back. So that was like mainly my inspiration. And when a lot of people ask me like, oh, like, where do I start? I'm like, well, location, location, location. That's where you got to, you know, if you know your market, you know, it's going to be high foot traffic. You love the people there, the whole community. So that's kind of how I got started with it. And for sure, the first year, was definitely stressful, but then, like everything else, you just, you educate patients, you bring excitement to the day, and then it builds on itself. So it's been now, we opened in April 2021. I guess 3 years now. Yeah, 3 years and change.
Yeah, you're right. It does a lot have to do with location because it's not only having like a primo location and a storefront, it's knowing your audience as well. And I think that plays a lot into like the psychology of talking to patients and talking to parents, especially if you're trying to get a more pediatric patient base. So we met through Ascani, the Optometric Society of the City of New York, and we were introduced to each other because we had both done the pediatrics continuing education lecture. Do you feel like you were always a peds person from back when you were even in optometry school, or is this something new that came about years into practice?
Kind of a similar story as being a practice owner. I didn't think it was in my cards. And even when I opened Sur Eye Care, I did want to cater to a pediatric community, pediatric patients, but I didn't really see it becoming, fast forward, right? It mainly became the main focus. And like that is all I see all day long, like little kids. And it just became into that. But backtracking a little bit, because I graduated a while ago now in 2015. When I first graduated, I had that the classic limit that you hear, right? Oh, I see 10 years old and up only, right? Like that's all I would see. And I didn't recognize, like, I think for a lot of us that happens, right? We think we like some things, and things that come easily to us, we don't notice that we're really good at it. So I never noticed that I was really good with kids, and everybody would tell me, and I'd be like, yeah, but like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm into that. So yes, I started seeing 10 years old and up, and I started doing, like most new grads, fill-ins. And these fill-ins, at times they would ask me, like, there's a 9-year-old, can you see them? And then I'd be like, sure. And then at another fill-in, it would become younger. Like I have an 8-year-old, and I'm like, okay. And then they're like, please, they have a brother, and slowly that number started going down. That number started going down for me until it just from a necessity standpoint, I got comfortable seeing kids 5 and up, 4 and up, right? And then when I was able to start at Metropolitan Hospital, which is NYC Health and Hospitals, there's a huge need there. And the need became, there's many children needed to be seen, and it was more of like 2 years old and up. And that's like what my new challenge was. And I'm like, I can do that, sure. So for a while, I was doing 2 years old, like a children and up. And then after starting Sur Eye Care, I thought that was going to be like, okay, 2 years old. But I became an infancy provider, and the need was there too. So now I'm seeing kids who are 6 months old and up because there's a great need. And I don't know, a lot of people say that in New York it is difficult to find pediatric care, because I'm sure as you do, right? I have patients coming from really far, and they're like, oh, I had to look so hard to find someone who would do this. And I mean, yeah, I guess I'm not really sure why. Maybe it's like a corporate thing, or yeah, but how about yourself? You said you have you always been into peds, or?
So, no. And I think the reason be for that was because, like you, I was doing a bunch of fill-ins when I had first graduated starting out. And I would always get that phone call from parents saying, like, hey, my kid is, under the age of 6 or 7. I've called every single optical. No one will see them. Can you see them? And look, in the beginning, I do kind of get it because when you're working in an optical setting, especially in New York, how you mentioned it's hard to find a peds doctor in New York, they schedule you if for every 15 minutes a patient. And when you think about it, you can't really get down to kind of the nitty-gritty of a problem with a kid, especially if you have to cyclo them in just 15 minutes. So I understand why some doctors didn't want to do it from a standpoint of, I feel bad because I'm so trained with school and the stuff I learned in optometry school to give a really, really good quality eye exam. On the flip side of that, when I started working at the pediatrics office, when I was in that office that's doing both mostly vision therapy and myopia management, I was seeing kids who are really young for binocular vision workups. And then when going back to the other practices that I'm at that are, just primary eye care, family eye care, when they would ask if I can see kids that age, I already had, I guess, the tool set and the confidence to do it. And I found that it became a huge practice builder because families want to all see the same optometrist. Whoever sees your kids, sees the parents, and then you just know the whole family. So eventually, by seeing these kids and also by being an infancy provider, you're building your practice because infancy is a free exam. It doesn't pay you. And, but it's worth it because one, you're serving the community and people recognize that and they will come to you and trust you as a doctor. So now I see kids in all my offices. So I'm like that one of the office that they'll call where they say, "Hey, I've called everyone else in the area. They won't see my kid." And I'm like, "Sure, bring them in. I'll see your 3-year-old."
Yeah, and I think too, what when you're mentioning this, the infancy, how it's a free program, I think many providers like do wrongly think that, hey, they're mostly going to be healthy and I have nothing to bill. Meanwhile, there's like a lot that you can do. And even apart from that, even if they are healthy, it's a huge practice builder because I don't know what I used to think before I was like in the new parenting phase. I thought people didn't have kids. I thought there was like a, like, what's that? Like a crisis? There is no crisis. Everybody has three kids, four kids. So even if you see that one healthy one, they have multiple brothers and sisters, cousins. It's a huge practice builder. And when you go off into like vision therapy or myopia management, it's not, you know, it's not just healthy people you have nothing to bill for. It's healthy kids you have nothing to bill for. It's in fact a huge part and a huge important role that we play.
Right. Like when you see them first for their infancy exam, it's essentially a screening and to tell the parents for when do I want to see them next. I'll kind of like, lay it on the line. I got my first eye exam when I was 20 years old. So I did not get eye exams as a
Okay.
kid. And I mean, I'm a
You're
minus
good.
one.
You're
Yeah, I'm a minus one.
okay,
So
good.
I don't have a crazy prescription. But the thing is, growing up, my parents did not know. They always asked me, "Hey, can you see?" And I would say, "Yeah, I can see fine," because I didn't know any
Right.
better. So how do you handle patient education when it comes to educating parents on the importance of first eye exams, even before their kids are at school age?
Well, I mean, the need is definitely there. Parents are often shocked when I tell them, well, 6 months, at 6 months old, they should be having their first one. I must have been like my first real eye exam was had to be middle school, so it had to be like sixth grade around then. And then I had my first pair of glasses there. And you know, similarly to you, like I asked my parents, like, how did you know to listen to me? Like, because I think I said something. I was like, well, I can't see the board all of a sudden. So my last name is R. Raimondi. So in like when the seatings, I was always in the back and I would always see in the classroom. But then all of a sudden 1 year I couldn't. And I'm like, how'd you know to listen to me? And they're like, well, we listened to you and we took you. But in terms of educating parents, well, I guess it's interesting. You know, a lot of parents don't understand, but sometimes I'll have to tell them, like, hey, look, you're here because two people are saying your child needs help. You got either like a failed vision screening from school, and that's how you found me. So the two of us are saying that this kid needs some help. So it's not just me. Or it'll be like, okay, your pediatrician sent them over. So it's again, two of us, you know, confirming this. In terms of educating parents about it, I will admit, if I see an adult alone, I don't think I usually ask them like, hey, do you have kids? I don't know. But in terms of what when they're siblings, for sure, I'll be like, is there another sibling? Oh, they're too young. Like, no, they're not. Like, we need to check them too. Or when they bring one child in, I'm like, hey, this child has a, you know, it's an amblyopia suspect. This is hereditary. Like, we gotta bring him in. Or, well, I guess when an adult does have a different finding, I'll be like, wait, you know, is it possible that you have children? Let's figure it out and we go from there.
Yeah, I mean, the way I get kids is usually the two methods exactly how you said. Either they failed a school screening or the pediatrician sent them. So I'll see the kid that, got referred to me essentially, and then I'll always ask if they have siblings. There's like this whole psychology of explaining to the parent of why the sibling needs to be seen, even if they haven't failed a school screening, and they essentially the pediatrician didn't recommend them. And I think a lot of it is explaining to the parent that it's not just can they see the 20/20 letters on the eye chart uncorrected. I think there's an importance in educating the parents and the general public that there's just so much more to it. You have to make sure the eyes are working properly together so the eyes don't double when reading. Are all the structures of the eye healthy? How does vision relate to learning? And like how a lot of binocular disorders are actually misdiagnosed, either it's ADHD or behavioral problems. And whenever you're noticing something behavioral, like a avoidance of schoolwork, avoidance of near work, it's always good to get it checked out, even if there's no, like obvious, like out in the distance, I'm seeing blurry, I'm not squinting or anything like that. And I think it's just important to get that information out there to the parents. So I will push to, for them to bring the siblings in, even if they were not referred to me. But you're right, I don't ask every single adult, do
No,
they
you got me
have
thinking. I'm like,
kids?
maybe I should in like a different way, like if something comes up. But yeah, and I love how you said that you have to explain the different components of it. That's how I always break it down to parents. I'll be like, okay, wait, are you listening? I do that. I'm like, we check four different things in your kid's eye exam, right? So I'll be like, okay, one, I'm checking their eye health. Is there any major disease happening? There's not, all right? Little Johnny is great. Look at these pictures. Looks beautiful, all right? Two, I check if there's a glasses prescription. Is there one there that we need to address? Like, okay, yes, he does have one. The third thing is reason he might be coming in for a follow-up is I want to see how his visual acuity is developing because that glasses prescription might stay the same, might get worse, but what I'm really interested in is how that's forming and developing. And then the fourth thing is, are the eyes working together as a team? So we're checking all four different things. And then I'll go into detail, be like, wait, like, okay, we're checking on these things for your kid. And then they get it. Cause otherwise, right, it could be confusion with especially with a parent who's never worn glasses before or has ever seen an eye doctor, because that happens too. And then that way we break it down and connect all the dots together.
Usually what I'll do with the parent when they don't wear glasses and the kid has a prescription is like, let's say they're like a minus four. I'll put a plus four in front of the parent's eyes in a child frame and I'll be like, this is how your kid sees to kind of get them to understand. And then similarly with the eye teaming, like if they have a convergence insufficiency and everything's doubling up close, there's actually, you can get online these little demonstrators called double vision demonstrators, where it's a piece of paper and it's a paragraph on it, and the words are essentially doubling. So it shows the parent, this is how your kid reads, and that's why they're avoiding their near work and schoolwork, and that's why they might have, reading comprehension problems because they don't like to read when it's uncomfortable. So I think showing them is also a key way in helping them understand as well.
Oh yes, absolutely. Showing them is worth more than any amount of talking for sure.
And then I also go over how kids aren't just mini adults. Because they're developing. So I always say, how like with hand-eye coordination, the eye controls the hand, not the other way around. So especially if they're in any other services like occupational therapy in school with like how to hold a pencil, make sure you're bringing them in to get their eyes checked. Just to make sure everything's okay, that the eyes are working well together. You do myopia management in your practice as well. Do you do all three methods like Ortho-K, soft contacts, and atropine?
Yep, we offer all three. And in the beginning, it was hard to find patients for this because the majority of my kids have high SIL. So they're all like more than a minus three. It's very common to have that be like the first presentation of it. So A lot of times I was getting that compound hyperopic astigmat, but you know, slowly but surely the tables are gonna turn. And now I have more candidates for the other two, for soft contact lenses and then for ortho-K as well. But other than that, I'm heavy on the atropine because those hyperopic astigmats end up doing way too much screen time. And when they switch over and go into the myopic end, and that's where I come in.
Do you feel like you have more patients that are on atropine versus like soft contact lenses or ortho-K? Is there any specific type of patient that you would like push them more towards ortho-K or push them more towards the soft contact lens method? Like, how do you essentially decipher which method you're going to choose?
Oh, absolutely. If they are a candidate, they're more spherical or they have low sill, and if they're a candidate for the soft contact lenses or ortho-K, I absolutely say this is the way to go. This is where you're going to get the most benefit, and I encourage parents to go that route because it's also a glasses-free life, right? So then they're not breaking their frames all the time. They have all that freedom, and it's much more efficacious too that I've noticed. But it's not that atropine doesn't work, but I usually leave it more as a last resort. Like, okay, this child is a minus nine and they're out of everything, you know. That's unfortunately when parents decide to cave in as well. So that's when I go over to atropine, and you know, my minus four sill, minus five sill kids, so many of them.
Right. And what I always do is if I let the patients know if I think they're pre-myopic. So even if they're, like six, seven, or eight, and they're under like a plus a quarter or plus 50, I say, hey, if they're doing a lot of screen time, especially if they also have myopic parents, whether it's one parent or both, they're at higher risk for becoming myopic. And I'd rather, before we get into like, the really high myopes where it's harder. I always say, like, all right, if they're already going to be a minus one, minus two, I start the conversation of myopia management right away, then and there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. When it's that little bit, you just know it's going to get worse, and it's our job to educate parents. Like, hey, we know how it used to be. There didn't used to be treatments for this, but now there are, and we can do something about it now.
So going back to what you said about latent hyperopes, so you have a child, you cyclo them, you get way more plus prescription. How do you prescribe then? Is there a certain amount that you're always cutting down? What's your like go-to method?
I think it depends on age of the child. I think the younger they are, the less that I cut. So I do try to make sure that we're correcting for all the different possible amblyopia factors, possible amblyopia suspect factors. Of course, if there's any difference in positioning too, or if orthophoric position, anything away from that, I'm trying to prescribe the whole thing. If there's a large asymmetry, for sure, we're going to try to get the most out of it. I will end up cutting more if it's something really large and it's their first pair. Then you get a plus eight, or I had a plus 575 and plus three, plus 575 right at plus three in the left. I'm like, well, we don't want this kid hating the first pair of glasses and just not wearing them at all. So I will totally educate the parent and be like, actually, their eyeball is this. Their eyeball is a plus eight. Their eyeball is a plus five, but we are going to lower it for their comfort. And it's going to seem like it got worse the next time, but it didn't because it's a plus five right there. So that's how we'll often do it.
I think I'm pretty similar. What I'll do is I'll tend to first I'll look at their posture. So the more ESO they are, the less I'm gonna cut down because I want the lenses more plus to help open them up and align their posture. But I will go a little bit more less from the cyclo prescription because I always say you can always see them back in like 3, 4 months, and you can always increase it. My goal is to get them to actually wear the glasses because if you ever run into a scenario where you prescribe too much plus and they're blurry and they're not going to wear that first pair of glasses and they complain to the parent that their vision is blurry in the glasses, what happens is the parents kind of stop trusting you and trusting the process as much when you place that doubt in their heads. So I always say if you're ever unsure, give a little bit less, follow them closely, and then you can always see them back. And then, of course, if they have any amount of anti-SO, big difference between the two eyes, then you always want to push to prescribe. Any amblyogenic factor, you're always going to want to give them the RX. And with seeing patients with a lot of astigmatism too, like if they have with the rule astigmatism, I know I can get away with cutting a little bit more and then not as much with against the rule. And then with oblique, you can't really cut much there because you're just going to blur them. So there's little tips and tricks, but I think ultimately, as long as you have a reason, an explanation for why you're doing it, whether it's the posture, how often you're monitoring them, there is no concrete right answer. It's very subjective based on the child as well. So I know other doctors ask me that question a lot. They're like, how much should I cut? And I'm like, there is no exact formula. It's very case dependent. So I'm glad that you found that too with your exams, that it kind of depends.
Oh, yeah, it does depend. And I actually learned from a kid last month. I always try to give as much SIL as I can because these kids, they need it. They're good with it. And I had, two little stories. I had one parent go for a second opinion, and the second opinion was in plus SIL, but it was the same prescription that I wrote. So, like, I'm like, that's funny. Like, I patted myself in the back a little bit anyways. But what I was remembering right now was this mom. She came in with her little boy and she's like, he can't wear it. He's tripping all over himself. And I'm like, I was like, really? In my head, I'm like, really? He's tripping. I'm like, that's something that you hear from your first time progressive wearers at age 40. I'm like, tripping all over himself. I'm like, let's see. Let's have him put him on. And sure enough, he was like on a seesaw. And I'm like, okay, fine. I feel like I've never cut SIL in all these years of doing it. But with him, I'm like, all right, we will work our way back up. Let's change these. Mom, you're right. He's like, woo, moving all over the place.
Right. Patients are different. And I really think the most important thing is if anything's, standing out to you, just monitor the kid closely. There is no rule that says you have to see them exactly at 12 months. If you need to bring them back at 3, 4 months, bring them back at 3, 4 months. Because I also see really, really young kids. So I'll have like a 2-year-old patient, and let's say one eye is a plus 50 and one eye I'm getting a plus 125. So I'm thinking in my head, like for amblyopia, if it's a one diopter difference in hyperopia, then that's an amblyogenic factor. But in this case, it's plus 75. What do I do? Do I prescribe? And I will just monitor them. I will see them back in 3 months because what if in 3 months that plus 125, what if it does change to a plus 150? I just think the most important thing is if you're suspecting anything, just monitor them closely. And that's okay as long as you're explaining what you're doing and there's a reason for what you're doing.
And parents appreciate that. And for the most part, they do come back when you tell them that. Like, if you say, like, I need to monitor, they may be too young for this. And the next in 3 months more, they're gonna know their alphabet better. They're going to develop further. Parents come back for that for sure and appreciate it.
Yeah, and I think there's things that, even if you're in a primary care family clinic, there's little things that you can do to just actionable steps to see kids, like cover tests. These are quick things that can let you know if you're not fully comfortable, you can always identify the problem and then refer to a binocular vision specialist or a vision therapy office. But I think there's steps that you can take to kind of like how you said you were lowering the age 1 year at a time when you were doing fill-ins to see kids. Is there any other steps that you think we can take as optometrists to just get more comfortable seeing kids?
I love that point that you made about referring. We can't know everything. And parents and all not even just parents, even adults, right? If there's something that you see in a primary care setting that you say, like, well, this is like you need a subspecialist for this. Patients follow through and appreciate it so much when you send them off to a contact lens specialist, to vision therapy. They don't know that these are available to them, and we do. So it's our job to be able to like send them off to where they would best be served, right? Whether it's for surgery too or anything like that. But I think thinking back on my journey, for sure, like you implement cover test. And I got to the point too, like a couple years out, where I would need to have like a stereo book in all the offices. You could just ask. Sometimes maybe you feel like you can't when you're a new grad, but like, you know, hey, like let's get all these things ready to go. I do want to see kids, but I will need time to cycle them. We need to have these things in stock, right? Or getting the names of people who do see children, you know, getting that lined up, connecting with your pediatrician. But like another actionable thing you can do, I guess it's what I did. Just lower your age a little bit. Push yourself out of your comfort zone. So if you now see, I just saw yesterday, sees 8 years old and up, right? You can see seven, you know. And it's funny because I'm sure for you and me, like a 7 year old is like, oh, that's a grown, that's
Easy.
grown folks already, you know. Give me four and up, I'm good, you know. Not even. And then even the younger ones are even easier. But it's there is such a need there, and you are the best as an optometrist. You're the best and most qualified to be able to direct them to wherever they need to go. And you might not, maybe you don't know vision therapy that well, but you can identify if there's like a full like strab going on. So you would know, okay, where to send this parent to, or if a child might benefit from patching and maybe you don't have room in your schedule to do that. Again, you would like know where to send the child to. Or myopia management, same thing. Like I have other ODs sending them to me. They might not have room in their schedule to do it, but I'm there, so I'm happy to see them.
Yeah, it's always good to connect with other ODs and let them know that, hey, I'm a referral source. I'm here for you. If you see anything weird, you can always refer to me. I love what you said about stereo, getting a stereo book. That is such a quick way to, if they don't have normal stereo, something's up. That's a quick way to let you know that they're not using both eyes together. And that's actually the first test I do with kids. I'll do stereo and color before I even do visual acuity because I don't want to break binocularity. So I don't want to break fusion. So the first thing I do is first exam, throw on the stereo glasses and just make sure they have proper stereo. And then I'm like, okay, you know what? At least I know both eyes are working together at some point. So I think that's a really good actionable step, and it takes 2 seconds to do stereo. So it's not something you need to like add a bunch of extra time on your
And it's
schedule
fun.
for.
Yay.
Yeah.
It's
Yeah,
always
you t
fun.
I know you tell them like look at these 3D shapes. So yeah, I totally agree. Another thing that we mentioned briefly earlier is your involvement in Sites of Health. Can you elaborate on your role there? And do you have any experiences you'd like to share from going on mission trips?
Well, I first found them through a SUNY email blast back when I was a student. I think it was like around 2013. And well, both of my parents are from Peru. And I noticed that this Sites on Health at the time was called A Promise to Peru. And I was reading that they did surgical mission trips to Cusco in the Andes region. And I just thought, like, that's perfect. It's everything I love. It's eye care and a chance to give back, or to like get to know like my parents' like homeland. So I emailed them. There was an application process to sign up, and I was able to go in the summer of 2014. And that was the first time, and I went back like I think five more times since then, most summers. I think 2014, 2015, yes. And then four of them were in Peru, one was in Ecuador. And what it is we see patients who need, everybody needs eye care. Well, there's a great need everywhere, locally and globally as well. But when you go to developing nations, they really don't have any access to the sort of care. What happened in the one region that we went to is that the government for that for the one city, they were able to build a small clinic, and they did that, but they weren't able to provide any employees or healthcare professionals to that clinic. And so there was just this empty place that was ready to receive different mission workers, mission trips. So we went there, and it's like a collaboration between optometry and ophthalmology. So I guess I'd say it's mainly Long Island based. And every year they go back. They just went a few weeks ago. And their this was I think this trip was the first one since COVID happened, because like after that it became different. But it was it's a really rewarding and gratifying experience. And of course, it mainly focuses on cataract surgeries, which everybody of even here in New York, all walks of life benefit from it tremendously. And we still see dense cataracts, right? Whether you're rich, whether you're poor, whatever, everybody's walking around with a grade four, and then they just don't nuclear sclerotic lens, and they don't even know it because they got so used to it slowly changing. But that's what we definitely saw a lot of, some congenital cataracts, which that's always life changing when you're able to like get it on like a 15-year-old and then just like get that out. There was one little boy who was playing outside, and he came in, he got in line in a really long line of patients, and he got a piece of metal in his eye. And if we weren't there, that was just going to be there forever. But we were able to go in there, do our thing, and get him all squared away. And we would also take glasses donations too, so any like large myopes or large hyperopes, they were able to start seeing things clearly.
That's so awesome. And the fact that you said that little boy that got the metal in his eye, it would just be there because he had no access to healthcare. I think that really shows how, as optometrists, we can give back to the community and, just really make a difference. Can any optometrist join, and how long are the trips?
Yeah, any optometrist can join up. You go to sightsonhealth.org, and we can put a link in your description. All right? But yeah, any optometrist can sign up, and usually the trips are like 1 week long, a little shorter at times. It's a lot of hard work, but it's really gratifying, and it's a way that we can give back too.
Yeah, that's really awesome. I will definitely check it out. I love travel. I've actually been in that area too, in Cusco and the Andes, and it's just so beautiful there, and it's almost like a different pace of life.
It's gorgeous. The sun just hits just right.
Did you get to go around there? Off topic, but did you go to like Rainbow Mountain and Machu Picchu?
I never been to Rainbow Mountain, but I've been to
Oh.
Machu Picchu twice now because of that. So it's yeah, that's plenty of room, plenty of time to see, plenty of time to see all the sights, and then all the different people there too. So now I'm like the go-to person for like anybody like going to Machu Picchu. They're like, oh, what do I do? Like, where to go? I'm like, oh yeah, like I got that. It's like, it's good stuff.
Yeah, definitely. It's so awesome to just get out there. It gives you such a different appreciation for life.
So for me, like on a personal level though, I'm used to never be like a good traveler. Like I don't know, like I didn't have any stamina before, but I guess you just grow older and you get better at it. But in one of the medical mission trips, well, every time actually, I don't know if you had that experience, but because we're in like more remote areas, the hotels that we would stay at for the mission trips had many times only cold water, and you'd only like shower with only cold water. And then in one of the years, the water completely shut off. Which it sounds when you tell someone else, it just sounds like, wow, like how could you even go through that for like, I think it was like 2, 3 days where there was no potable water, no shower, nothing like that. But it wasn't that bad looking back. Like it really was not, which is fascinating. And then people always tell me when I share that story, they're like, how did you even survive? I'm like, I don't know, but you make do, you just it's you work together. When there's no option, there's no option, and then you end up like adapting to it. But I mean, that's something that I guess it surprises me about myself too. Like there was no toilet, there was no sink. We made it happen though, and it was fine.
I mean, it gives you perspective because some people live there full time. Like you're there for your week or two, but this is how they function. So it just really gives you a good life perspective on how things could be different and how you can really help the communities and also learn about yourself and that community too. So I just think that's really awesome. Do you have anything else to add, from like a pediatric standpoint or just like a practice standpoint? I know you work at NYC Health Hospitals. Any interesting stories or ocular disease stuff? You're just so awesome to talk to. So I just wanted to know if there was anything else you
Oh,
wanted to share.
there's so many awesome stories. That's the best part about working in New York. Yeah, you always meet that one family or that one person with a really rare eye disease. I've been, what is it? So last year I had a boy come in and I saw him from far away, right? Like, you know, I peek out from my exam room. I'm like, who's there? And he's coming in, and I'm like, why is he only wearing one gray color contact lens? I'm like, I'll figure it out, I guess. I don't know. But it wasn't that. It's just that he had a bright blue iris, a bright blue iris. And I was like, what is this Fuchs? What's going on? And it turns out, after doing some investigating, that he has Waardenburg syndrome, and that inspired one poster for Academy, and it's just beautiful photos and findings on that. And then I remember emailing everybody like, okay, who knows about this? Who can tell me more about Waardenburg syndrome? Like I was trying to find someone who like knew about it. And they're like, I don't know. Like I don't have experience with it. And I'm like, oh my God, like, is it me? I'm supposed to find out all about this. And then I found this other lady came in, really nice, 40-year-old. You could guess her complaint, Mary. She comes in, she is
I
having a
can't
hard
see
time.
up close.
Yes, she cannot see up close at all. And I'm like, all right, let's take a look. And then I always dilate everyone. I'm like, hey, wait, neat, hey, that optos can only go so far. You see so much else. And I look in. And then I see perfectly pixelated white dots on her retina, almost like it was printed. I was like, what is this? And she's like, oh yeah, like me and my sister have always had night vision issues, by the way, but we've never had a diagnosis. And investigate a little more. Turns out she had fundus albopunctatus. And then I went on a I was able to put a poster together for SECO for that. And I learned about all these other different night vision things, which you think would help me with this other 40-year-old lady that I saw last week. She was actually really upset, you know, because she's slowly becoming truly legally blind. She's like 20/300 in her right eye, 20/300 in both eyes, right? She's slowly losing her vision. And she has night vision issues, and so does two of her siblings. And she has three children who have not been examined yet, but they will be. We're getting them together. And I was thinking she had gyrate atrophy, so she doesn't have that. I was thinking maybe choroideremia. It's not that. So she's getting genetic testing done. But yeah, that's a little bit about my life. Oh, and then last year we saw a patient with Axenfeld-Rieger syndrome. He almost like he didn't have he had no pupils basically at all. And I was like, what is this? And then we worked with ophthalmology. They did like a pupilloplasty, and they got him seeing 20/40, 20/60 uncorrected. And it's bittersweet. He moved. We were following him. So I was gonna, you know, I was gonna do like a presentation or something on him. But he ended up moving back to Mexico But at least he can see, so he's happy that he moved back, because we were getting him set up with for specialty contact lenses. So it's like, okay, we blasted that, get you over, because I don't do specialty contact lenses. And I think, yeah, he still has a trial pair sitting at SUNY somewhere, but he moved back. So sad, but he's happy.
You know what I love about your response to this question and all these awesome stories from like NYC Hospital is that as you're telling them, I'm like thinking, okay, this is the diagnosis. No, wait, this is the diagnosis. And everything that you're adding, everything that you're telling me, I'm kind of like adding together and piecing together. And I'm just thinking that this goes exactly with the advice that I always give to new grads, how you're not going to know every single symptom. You're not going to know every single sign of everything ever. There's going to be things that if you don't see them often, you're just going to forget. And it's totally okay to look up in Will's eye. It's totally okay to ask colleagues. It's totally okay to bounce ideas and learn from each other.
They don't think it's okay. I'm like, I look things up all the time. I have like students ask me that. I'm like, I didn't know. You gotta ask, like you're saying, ask colleagues.
I
Yes.
know in none of the four stories you just mentioned, did I know exactly what it was going to be right away? And I think that's just a perfect example of how we can all learn from each other. And truthfully, when I saw you worked at NYC Health Metropolitan, I was like, oh, I gotta ask her if she has cool stories because, like, what a treat. So thank you so much for sharing that. Thank you so much for joining me today and kind of going back and forth to compare notes on how we handle pediatric eye exams in our practices and going over the clinical pearls. And I hope other optometrists listening can use this in their exams to be able to see more kids as patients and educate parents on the importance of getting kids in for their eye exams early. And how getting kids' eyes checked is so much more than just can they see 20/20. And then you can also introduce the idea of vision therapy, myopia management programs to parents if the kid needs it. So I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me on this. This is really a treat getting to go back and forth with you.
Likewise, thank you so much for having me. This was so fun. We gotta do it again.